And the reason you've all come is to hear Professor Danny Dorling, who I am sure for many of you needs very little introduction. Dan has been here at the University of Oxford since 2013. He is the Health and Mackinder Professor of Geography. And I would say that probably of all the academics in Oxford, you are probably someone who does, in a way, more public engagement through your policy work. And he's one of those academics who is a very robust academic, really sort of leading thinking. But he's also willing to write and talk. He publishes in things like The Economist and in The Guardian. He and I both appeared together at the Hay Festival and other festivals. And if you haven't seen, I think it's called, is it World Mapper? Which is a wonderful, Danny is a geographer, therefore his talks are always very, very visual. And it is a wonderful website, and you can find the link either through our website or through Danny's, which looks at things like inequality and poverty in different parts of the world. And today he is going to be talking to us about basically the impact of future generations of inequality, the impact on future generations of inequality in the housing market. So thank you so much for coming and talking to us, and over to you.
That's great. Thank you ever so much for that introduction. Thank you ever so much for coming along today as we begin to slowly get back to normal. And what I'm going to do, it's going to take about 40 minutes, is talk to you a little bit about housing. Then I'm going to talk to you about inequality, and then I'm going to try and bring the two things together again. But the first thing I've got to try and work out how to do is how to share my slides. And so I shall stick them up, I shall start them playing, and I shall tell Microsoft security options to go away. Cancel. And I've got the slides, but the question now is how to get them in the little screen. This is a brilliant test for older academics. It's a way of getting us to work out whether we can still do it or not. Share screen, that screen, share. Now, Sarah can hopefully see, but is that working?
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Okay, and for you two in the room. This is going to be partly speculative as well, because of course we have no idea what's going to happen in the future. I have to say this at the beginning, because you'll notice I've become increasingly confident as we go on about what the future is going to happen, what's going to occur, but at least in the start I can say we don't know. But we know a lot about what has happened in the past. And it's this graph in particular that made me want to do this talk. And it's the subheading that The Economist magazine gave to the graph, which I'll show you in a minute, which particularly incensed me. The graph is from the English Housing Survey. Goes back to 1993, back to when I was a student and renting, and it shows you the proportion of people who are renting privately over time from 1993 up to the present by age. And so you can see the enormous rise in the 25 to 34 year olds. But also beneath them, you can see the 35 to 44 year olds. This is England, apologies for people from other countries. You see this kind of thing in the USA. I would argue you don't see it so much in countries which are better organised. You can see it in the 45 to 54 year olds, the age group I'm in now. And a slight rise in private renting in 55 to 64 year olds. But what we're interested in is what's going to happen in the future, which way is it going? Now you may notice those curves dipping down more recently. You might think, oh look, the 25 to 34 year olds, they've managed to get a mortgage. Buy a house. That isn't true. What's happened is that more of them are staying at home with mum and dad rather than even private renting, up to age 34. And it's one option. I can go to towns in the south of England, particularly towns which have a lot of right to buy, and see that many, many people are now living in households of three generations. But it's not great. So this looks like bad news. because of the way we organise renting in this country, for people who don't know, renting here is precarious. You can be charged whatever somebody wants to charge you, and outside of the pandemic, they can evict you with just 2 months' notice. It's not much fun private renting. Most people don't want to be doing it if they can avoid it. Here's the headline and the subheadline. So the headline is, this is April 21st in The Economist, when Britain's generation rent retires, the subhead, people who never buy houses will become an expensive problem. Now, so here's the question. Will it be them who's the problem? What is the problem? Who is actually the problem? How might we solve the problem? There is certainly going to be a problem. The reason why The Economist wrote that is it costs more to privately rent a home than it does to get a mortgage. It costs far more than social housing. It's the most expensive way to live. You can just about manage it if you're working. You may get some housing benefit that helps. But a huge amount of your income, possibly half in some cases, sometimes more, will go on rent. What happens when you want to retire? What happens then? Is the government going to pay the rent, all these private landlords? Or are we going to make all the old people of Britain who are not in the richest third move somewhere where it's really cheap to live? I don't know. That's the kind of question I want to answer. And I'm going to answer it partly by just showing you lots of pictures. I'm a geographer, I like graphs. This is a zoomed-in part of a graph, so that at least you can see it. The point here is that the two lines, diagonal lines, are largely straight. I'll show you real data in a minute. But essentially, this is the golden cohort, the group for whom it became normal to be able to buy. Buying, by the way, is not a panacea. In an ideal society, you have about 50% of people owning, 50% renting. You buy if you want to do DIY. You rent if you don't like DIY. That's your term. Nobody makes any money out of it. Landlords well behaved, otherwise they go to jail, and so on. We're a long way away from that. So, you've zoomed in on that 70%. Let me show you the actual graph, which is harder to see. This is data from 1983 all the way to 2012. Data from age 18 to 90, proportion of people who have a mortgage who will own outright. And you'll just see this generation trundling through. The far corner triangle to me is very old people, because in the past, my grandfather's generation, 90% privately rented, that's what you did. And you can see them dying out in that faraway triangle. And then you can see for the young people in the room, that's you coming in to kind of replace my grandparents' generation, as you're facing a 10-year life that's like them. Here's the actual data. So it's been stylized slightly, but those lines were worked out by hand. And this is the only time when the Telegraph newspaper has ever published an article by me. And I've tried to get in more than once, because it's far more useful being in the Telegraph than the Times. The Telegraph were willing to publish that graph actually in the newspaper, because the children of Telegraph readers, the grown-up children of Telegraph readers, are having problems buying houses. And that gives me some kind of hope for the future, over what might happen, a little bit of hope. What's the context of this? Just stepping back. There are lots of reasons for why all this has happened, but for me, underlying them are these curves. This is the share, at the top it's the share of the best off 1% of the 1% of income worldwide. I always think of Lady Marchmont, who owned Brideshead, in Brideshead we visited, if you want to know what the 1% of the 1% were. They had servants. Their income was enormous, it comes right down to the 70s and goes up again. There's a log scale on that graph. Below that is the 1 in 1,000, then the third line down is the 1%, the fourth line down is the top 10%. You take about 40% of all income. We became more equal. We arranged many things better. It became possible, for instance, in this city for car workers to buy a house with a mortgage in their early 20s and start a family. Right? That was the 1970s in Oxford. I know, because I was there. And then we go back the other way. There are other things that look similar, not necessarily directly related, but this is the average age of women having children. Now, it isn't simply because it's copying that. Women don't go out and check the 1% level and then decide what's happening. But it's related. So the average age was quite high in the past, partly because we had lots of servants. It was the most common job for women 100 years ago. And you couldn't have a baby if you were a servant. So that comes down as inequality comes down as the rich have to lose their servants, like Leslie Marchmont and Pricehead. It then rises up again, and it's a really interesting statistic, more than numerical, because you're waiting for it to curve. Right? It should curve. There are natural biological reasons why it cannot carry on, but we know where it can't get to. As yet, when it comes out every year, it has not curved one iota. And of course it's related to being able to start a family, get a home, and so on. This came out yesterday from the Resolution Foundation, so I just thought I'd put it up for those of you, a bit like me, who have a strange neurological complaint where I get very bored in talks, so I want to be fed from a constant set of other things I can look at. Just look at the annual growth column. That's the average disposable income increase per year since 1955 in the various governments. The Resolution Foundation put this out, I think, partly to tease the current government because the official projection is awful. It came out in the budget a couple of days ago. It's the 0.01 at the end. But in general, you'll see disposable income over time, irrespective of party, is actually dropping. The amount of money that went in terms of wealth and capital increased as it became more unequal, disposable income fell. There's quite lots of misery, I'm afraid, in this kind of talk and what I do in Britain. We have other huge inequalities. This is the Eurostat graph from 2017 about regional inequality in European countries. And if you look carefully, you'll notice that the vertical axis has been split because the UK is so enormously geographically unequal that it couldn't be put on a normal map by the European statisticians. Right. This is a very strange country. The fact we're sitting in a rather strange building at the end of Broad Street in a rather strange city, kind of, I can go on and on about the strangeness of the UK. The challenge I often say to students if I show them that graph is try to work out which is the second most geographically unequal country in Europe. So which of those bars, the UK has the widest bar, which of those bars is the next widest? And what I think you'll see is, oh, there's lots of them that are similar, because they're all properly European and kind of decent. But there's something odd, something different about the UK, about what we're willing to put up with, what we think is okay. This is GDP per capita by region. Inequalities. Here's an old map of inequalities from the 1890s. Data, I think, collected in the 1880s. Part of London where areas are coloured black and blue for the vicious, semi-criminal, poor, through to yellow for the servant-keeping classes, at least on one map it's called that. And there's a modern kind of version of the map for the index of deprivation. If you're interested in inequality, there's lots and lots about inequality. So much in a way that we're kind of immune to it, we're sort of used to it. I'm going to quickly give you some more before I get back to housing. Households below average income is the government data set that's released every year that tells us most about inequality, including for households with children. And these are the kind of statistics which, when you first hear them, shock you. But then very quickly afterwards, you absorb it and just think of it as normal. The pink is a couple of years earlier than the blue data, but essentially, in the poorest fifth of households, which only recently contained 28% of children, not a fifth, half of all children have no summer holiday. In the next fifth of households, 45% have no summer holiday, which contained another 28%. So that's 52%, so that's the majority of children. So this is a country in which, that little calculation here is from the most recent data, 30% of children have no summer holiday. So when you come back from, well, what we call the holidays, teachers no longer say, write me a story about what you did on your holiday. And that wasn't the case in the past. But it's an odd country, and it's connected with housing, and housing is connected with inequality. This is the Gini Index of inequality. It doesn't really matter which measure you use nowadays for inequality. It's a set constructed by the Institute of Fiscal Studies. It was very low in the 60s and 70s, and by very low, what I mean is, of large European countries, the UK was second only to Sweden in terms of inequality. This was a Scandinavian country in my childhood, in this city, in the 1970s, when objectively measured. My rose-tinted glasses of my memories of childhood holidays, or schools, or cycling around Oxford, or how the university students used to cower down there because they were slightly scared of local children, right? Those rose-tinted, they will be rose-tinted memories, but they're also statistically partly true. We were much more on the level. There wasn't much need for levelling up in the 1970s because we'd never been more level than it was. The state schools in Oxford had just been changed from secondary ones and grammar schools all into comprehensives. Nobody had a clue. Nobody knew what's the posh school. Charwell up to the north was a secondary modern. Piers down to the south used to be the county grammar. You know, so, sorry, for those of you who have no idea where they're sitting in this city, it's very different now. Now a third of children in the city go to private schools, of which there are many. Between the six, possibly seven now state schools, we've got a new one. There's an average housing price gap of £100,000. If you told somebody that in the 70s, they'd laugh at you. Yeah, let alone the idea that a house might cost £100,000. Let alone that the gap might be £100,000. The graph you can't see is the OECD ranking of countries by income inequality. I'm going fast because I've said this so many times, and for so many years now. We're the most unequal country in Europe, except for Bulgaria. So we are very, very, very unequal. By the way, the flatness of those lines really matters. Right. There is a qualitative difference between having just become very unequal, where you kind of have anger and bias and so on, and you know, a sense of what you've lost, which we had in the 1990s, and 25 years of living with very high inequality. It's very different. And part of the reason why those housing graphs are going in the direction they are is that high inequality doesn't mean that things aren't getting worse. Lots of things continuously get worse and worse and worse just because they're up at that level. And that is often not realised. So the Standard Institute of Economic Affairs, Dufton Street, far right response to this is, inequality hasn't risen for 25 years, what are you worried about? You know. It's like saying to somebody, look, you've had really high blood pressure for 25 years, you'll be absolutely fine. Like, it's not good. Here's some other countries. I've studied Canada, Germany, Finland, and the OECD average of Britain, which nicely sits between the other series. And you might think, oh, they're not very far down. There's not much of a difference. It's all the difference in the world when it comes to housing. Finland at the bottom is the only European country to have almost no homelessness, possibly the only country in the world to have almost no homelessness. Germany has a system where landlords have to buy their tenants out if they want them to move. You have to offer a sum of money that you increase until the tenant goes, okay, I'll move then. Well, don't. Can you imagine that in Britain? And you can't just increase the rent. Canada is a much nicer and more pleasant place to live than here. I'm trying to rile you up for questions a bit later, but it's not good. Other effects that this has. This is public spending, IMF data. Public spending as a proportion of GDP, all the way from the 80s forward to 2026, because countries tell the IMF what they're planning to spend. Sunak may have moved that up, but only by about a millimetre on the graph. So don't think this has actually been updated. And if you look at this graph, You can think it's going up because public spending is everywhere going up. And you'll see a jump at the time of the financial crash 2008 for bailing out the banks. And then you'll see austerity coming all the way down. And then you'll see the COVID jump for public spending. And then the post-COVID plans. And what I think is really funny is that our government actually tells the IMF what it's going to do and they publish it. And then we ask ministers what they're going to do. We don't need to ask them. You just go look at the IMF figures and say, well, you're planning to make these cuts. You've already told the IMF you're going to do it. Anyway, there's the UK. Here's the other four large European countries, Spain, Germany, Italy and France. The gaps are enormous. France is at about 55% of GDP, as opposed to the UK, just over 14%. That's a couple of health NHS years. It's decent school spending. You can go on and on about the differences. It's enormous. They're putting most of the rest of Europe, and you'll see we're still at the bottom. The country I haven't put in is Ireland because its GDP data is not particularly useful, because of some large American companies in Dublin. Not say any more about that. But they make the GDP look enormous, which make the public spending look small. And we're at the bottom. And it's really odd. And to an extent that, and you can see I'm getting a bit obsessive about these graphs, the only two countries which were lower than us were Spain and Greece. And that was only in the aftermath of them being run by military juntas and fascists. You know, it's kind of quite extreme. And as soon as Spain and Greece become proper democracies, they head towards proper public spending. And in some way, you know, at least the government overturned the decision this morning about letting a minister off. It was quite exceptional. But it is worth talking, I think, about to what extent are we a proper democracy when it comes to inequality and public life and so on. Let's try and humanise this. So almost at the end of this part on inequality, this is what I've been, this has been my pandemic project. We're trying to work out how do you explain levels of inequality in this country in a way that might get through to people. And the way I've tried to do it is to identify seven typical children. I've given them the names, Adoja, Brandon, Candice, David, Emily, Freddie, Gemma. They're slowly becoming more and more real to me, as I didn't get to meet people in the pandemic. Their incomes are taken from the government surveys. They are the middle child of the bottom seventh, the middle of the next seventh, up to Gemma, the middle child, the median at the top seventh. The amount of money that their family have a year, it depends what audience you're talking to, whether you say weekly, monthly or yearly, I'm going to give you a lot yearly, is in that middle column, and that's after tax and after benefits and after housing costs. But Adoja and her mum, she's probably just with her mum, they're getting by on just over £6,000 a year. Not the poorest child, 7% poorer. The next child, £12,000. The next one, they're 16. This is the household income of the family, so usually it's mum and dad. Then 19, 28, 32. And then the posh kid, Gemma, household income of 51, parents living in 51. Which means that all your associate professors and all the rest of the higher up echelons in this university, we're well posh in general. Your seven typical children in the UK are, as far as the middle class and upper middle class are concerned, all poor. And when you look at them, when you look at how people describe their own lives, they often think they're poor. A household in Oxford on an income of 51,000, say they own a small shop, in a city in which a third of children are going private, they can't afford to, but they're the middle child in the top seven. That's a weird kind of inequality situation we're in. And that's the graph on just a normal scale. You can turn it into money per child per day as well, £3.37 for a dojo. Everybody wants to look at the extremes. But it's actually the whole lot that matters. As we're kind of... When it's normal to be poor, it's very different from worrying about the poor. I'll quickly show you the upper levels. So what happens above Gemma? The 7th percentile, 6th, 5th, 4th, 3rd, 2nd, 1st. And here you play a game of houses. Here we can start talking. Marston, Cowley, Jericho, Cutslow, Summertown. You know, in this city you can start playing a game on this. What could you afford if you multiply it? And the incomes go from Gemma's £51,000 after tax and benefits for her family to £66,000, £71,000, £87,000, £121,000, heading towards Pro Vice Chancellor level now, £175,000. I stopped doing my equipment anymore. Top 1% meaningless mean £621,000. Meaningless mean because it's more inequality in the top 1% than there is in the rest of society. But it kind of does that. What it means is that everybody thinks that they're not doing that well because just a fraction above them, somebody's doing so much better. And when you look at housing, when you look at people's desperate attempts to borrow money to spend as much as they possibly can, and when I say people, I mean they're very well off, and borrow from grandparents to get a deposit or be given a deposit to buy a house that costs £450,000 or £500,000 or £600,000 or £1 million. It's all about playing games at this end of this scale. Or about buying houses because you're going to be a landlord where you're competing with the children of the rich. Back to house prices. I think I've got about 10 minutes left. It's a fool's game to try to guess what's going to happen. This is a nationwide house price series. Annoyingly, they published again yesterday, so it's out of date by day, but anyway. There it is. Your two slumps are the 1989 September slump, when the government got rid of something called double mortgage interest tax relief. And the slumps go on for quite a time, it's quite a few years, where house prices don't return to the level they were at. And then the 2008 financial crash, where we got back a little bit quicker than before. And then the kind of question is, when's the next one going to be? And you can't tell. But the longer it goes on, the bigger you expect the fall to be. If you change the axis of that graph to log it, I think this is interesting. But then I like graphs, so. But you log it, you see it's kind of curving downwards. So the kind of good news is it's not exponentially rising or even rising linearly that much. It is kind of coming towards an end. And there are some brilliant house price series data around the world, which the best is Amsterdam. People have been to Amsterdam looking at those houses on the canal. People have recorded every single sale of some of those houses. So we have records over centuries. Which means we know that house prices could fall in real terms for 200 years, which is my favourite statistic looking at Britain. Getting towards the end now. Institute of Fiscal Studies earlier this year, median inheritance as a percentage of lifetime net income. What can people expect in the UK to receive in terms of inheritance as compared to everything they've been paid for the jobs they do? Well, for the best off fifth, who almost all of us will either be in that or our families are in that in this room, not necessarily listening. For the best off fifth, if you're born in the 80s, you're expecting a third of everything you ever get to be money you inherit, on average. On average, because the housing market has become so large. If you're born in the 60s, it's about 15%, because you won't have as long to wait, it won't accumulate as much. It distorts the nature of society. You begin to have relationships with your relatives where you can't afford to fall out with them because otherwise you're going to have to live in a hovel. It changes how things happen. And of course it's distinctly unfair. This university, if you turn up with a very nice job in a college which doesn't happen to own many houses and you are bereft of family money, as it's called yourself, my back of the envelope estimations are that you stay 3 years here before you jump somewhere else because it's too expensive a city to live in. So it actually alters who can do what work where. Some pretty pictures to begin to end with. London really is odd. A bit like Istanbul and Moscow, the nearest equivalents. So that's the value, many years ago now, almost a decade ago I calculated that, the value of London compared to all the other big cities. That's a picture of London where the boroughs are made, the size of their housing equity. A few years before the great crash in Japan, so before 1990, somebody worked out that the Imperial Gardens of the Palace in Wigan, Tokyo was worth more, could have been more than the whole of California or something ridiculous. You do get up to incredible levels of inequality. Little cartoon, if you can't see it, came out a decade ago. The red is very rich and all the yellow apparently is losers, which isn't really quite true, but kind of contemporary thinking. Here's that same map done nationally, so you can just get an idea. And we've been affecting London. Oxford's a London borough. It's just, you know, it's got a couple of buses and two different railway lines. Oxford and Cambridge don't affect London boroughs, so I shouldn't really have those two blocks out. But it's very, very distorting. That graph is the proportion of children in England living in private renting. When various governments tried to get private renting to rise again, they never had it in their mind that this should be for families with children. Because in London, in private renting, you're moving on average every 3 years with children. If you move every 3 years, you lose all your friends, you have to go to a different school. It's fairly disastrous. And that was 2005 to 10, you see that ski jump going up. It's too depressing for me to update those figures to see what they are now, but we know that higher. I think we're almost at the end of the graphs. I hope we are. This is Becky Thompson's work. Becky took every census from 1911 onwards, the latest being 2011, because we're waiting for 2021 to get the data. And the most shocking thing is the line at the top, and that is the ratio. If you take the best off housed tenth of the population, and you work out how many rooms per person they got, and you take the most crowded tenth of the population at each census, and you work out how many rooms per person they got, and you divide one by the other, in 2011 you get 5-1. The best off housed, the people with the most spare rooms, these are elderly people living on their own in houses with lots of rooms, have on average 5 more rooms per person than the most crowded people. Now the history of it, if you go back, is fascinating, because it relates to those inequality curves I showed you at the start. It was 4-1 in 1911, and then it got a little bit worse by 1921, just as income inequality got a little bit worse. But then, from 1921 onwards, it fell and fell and fell and fell, just as income inequality fell. We shared our housing out better. And this is incredibly important, because the amount of housing you need depends on how you use the housing you've got. And if you use it inefficiently, you need to build loads, loads, loads more. The heady heights of equality were hit in 1981, after that wonderful 1970s decade, when it got to the utopia of 3 times more rooms for the best off 10th than the worst off 10th. Right? That's my memory of the best of times, of children living lives that are most similar to each other, and so on. And then this. Now, part of this, of course, is aging, which is finally the right place to talk about it. But it's aging without having policies to deal with that aging. So you end up, particularly in a pandemic, with people incredibly lonely in houses all on their own, they can't afford the heat. But part of it is not aging, part of it is widening inequality. Just 2 more slides. So where are we heading? These are my conclusions, so please have a think. It'll be interesting when 2021 comes out. It's remarkable that we actually need the census to do this, and we don't have the data in between to see what's happened to that ski jump inefficiency. But we're currently on track for ever less efficient use of our housing stock. That's what's happening. There are 200 Airbnbs for rent in Barton, which is the council estate, just 2 miles in that direction. 200 Airbnbs. So they're not being used for people who might be working in Oxford. And it's that kind of thing. It's Airbnb, holiday let, second home, accidental second home. you get together with them, you love each other, it's very nice and so on, but you keep both flats. You know, you accidentally become a landlord, that kind of thing. More and more rooms in our houses are empty. We have more rooms and more bedrooms per person than we've ever had. We have more bedrooms in London, not in hotels, forget all them, halls of residence. We have more bedrooms in private homes in London than we have people. So even if nobody wanted to share a bed with anybody else, we could actually house everybody easily in London. But increasingly we have empty rooms. And we have all kinds of reasons for the empty rooms. You know, all the kids need it when they come back from university, or when they split up from their boyfriend or girlfriend in their 30s, so we must keep a bedroom for them. You know, in ways that we didn't used to do. Or I need my nice house on the coast in Wales because it's where I go and relax because it's so hard working in Oxford. We're kind of like, fair enough, but there are families on the coast of Wales who would like to not be crowded. What do I think is going to happen as things carry on? More and more of the elderly are going to have to migrate towards cheaper private rented areas. The way things work, there's a limit on how much housing benefit you can have. So we'll be kind of filling up what people pejoratively call the red wall seats, which they're not poor, they're some of the posher areas of the north, including a very old population, which is why they're very conservative. But they're partly there because of this push away from the south, including people from the north who come down to the south to work for their working life and then retire back up in Rother Valley or whatever. Depends on things like Greater Grimsby that you associate with poverty, but the trick is the greater bit. It's outside, it's got villages in it, and so on. That's my guess. We're going to see an accelerated pushing away of the elderly towards cheaper housing areas. What would I do to solve it? I'd instigate the right to sell. The right to sell means that if you're having trouble paying a mortgage, you can sell the house, or if you don't like your private landlord, you can sell the house to a housing association or the council, and they become your landlord. And your landlord loses the house, will be compensated a bit, but maybe 40% below market rent, whatever the right to buy was the other way around. And the banks will be compensated a bit, but again, maybe 40% below, which should make them much more wary about renting, about mortgages that are very high. I think it's got no chance of happening until there's a crisis which hits the middle class. And the crisis which hits the middle class is a housing crash, where little Gemma and her boyfriend or her girlfriend have borrowed all the money from the grandparents they can to buy a one-bedroom flat in Dalston Junction in London, and it's just reducing value by 100 grand, which they owe to the bank. That's your negative equity now as compared to the 1980s. And the question is, what do you do for Gemma and her boyfriend or girlfriend? Are they saddled forever? And you do the right to sell. But it won't be people who never buy houses who are the expensive problem. It's the people who bought up the houses so they can be private landlords who are the expensive problem. It's the people who own many houses who are the expensive problem. Last slide is an advert. Which is a book on Finland, because the paperback came out this week. There are all these places you can look in Europe to see how to do housing and ageing better. They don't all do it better in every way, just on average they all live longer. They all have higher happiness indexes. They have fewer people on the streets, they have fewer people going cold, they've got better insulation and so on. So we should just start doing that. And finally, on inequality, countries that do best, they control their top 1%, so they don't take as much as they possibly can. I'll turn the sharing off now, and thank you very, very much for letting me walk on with you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to try and do something which we've done before. So if Nana's going to give you a microphone, if you come down here, we're going to turn the camera around so that all our colleagues who are online can see us here in the room. And Danny, if you sit in the front, and then... Brilliant. That's fantastic. And then Nana has a mic for those people who are roving mic. So thank you very much, as usual, incredibly stimulating, with lots of controversial ideas thrown out there for us to respond to. Those people who are online, if you want, you don't have to, but if you want to put your video screens on, then we can actually see some of you. If you could use the hand if you want to ask a question, and if people in the audience could put their hands up if they would like to ask Danny a question. So, shall we start here in the room? Kenneth. Thank you.
I was fascinated by the London graph.
Can you speak
I was fascinated by the London graph. I wondered to what extent you think this is a London problem, with all the people in the of London, and a house in London possibly being one of the best assets you can buy anywhere in the world if you want to achieve a wealth of music well.
So to what extent is it a London problem? I've had, what's his name? O'Neill was his surname. He did GB News, TV presenter, who was the anchor for them. He often would say, if you take London out of the UK, you take away the inequality, and this is a normal country with London taken out of it. So I did it. So I took London out and had a look. And the answer is that the UK's fractal. That you take London out and you find just as much inequality left, the patterns carry on. All our cities have an inequality gradient in them, which is very steep. Often people think they live in one of the most unequal cities, and they can tell you the road in Leeds or Sheffield or whatever, where you go from rich and poor, but it's similar. So it isn't just a London problem. Here our house price to income ratio, I think it's 16 or 17 to 1 in Oxford. You've got to go to San Francisco to sort of find a similar one. So London alone can't explain it. Houses are unaffordable in most of the cities of the Midlands and the south of England to most people now. But it certainly starts in London. It began in London. It emanates out. And in the past, when we've had crashes, they've actually begun a year earlier in London than elsewhere. It takes about 5 years to get up to Scotland. So in that sense, I'm saying it's not the problem. However, I'll contradict myself in a way and say, but if we were a different country, if we hadn't let London stay as powerful as it is, if, for instance, we put a wall halfway through London and cut it off, and created a federal country with different land and so on, okay, then you can imagine that England and Britain with a very different housing structure, but it wouldn't have London as dominant. And there is nowhere else, not Paris is nothing like it, there's nowhere else which allows this dominance. But the dominance of London partly reflects our current level of inequality.
Now, I was thinking particularly, you know, that the was it the OECD graph or the EU graph where, you know, the UK really stood out, but its regional inequality was being measured. So if you take London out, that presumably changes a lot, that particular graph.
It would change that particular graph, but within cities, say, when people talk about the 10-year, well, ours is only 10 years in life difference in Oxford, but in Sheffield it's 20 difference. In some areas, people on average live 20 years less than others. Other European countries do not have that degree of inequality within them. So we have a kind of replication. And it's a little bit, it's sort of totally colonial. And I'll never forget going to Newcastle University, where the advice from members of staff was to get themselves a house in an area called Jesmond or Gosforth, because, you know, that's where you would live if you came from the south, because it's the one place you might be safe. And there is very much a sort of way in which Britain is ruled by London and its offshoots, which are Oxford and Cambridge. You know, here you come out here for 3 years, having largely been in London and gone to North London Collegiate or Harrow or whatever. You come out for your 3 years and then you're straight back into London working for a PR company before you become a Member of Parliament and a Minister. And, you know, that, now other countries of course are centralised, but we are incredibly, incredibly centralised, and our leading families are well suited for housing, they're fine. The question is, you know, how many houses do they have? How do they buy a house for all of the children? Can you possibly live on the ministerial salary if you have a lot of children? You know, that's actually a problem.
Just before I go to Julian, can I ask you a question? So, presumably part of this shift that you identified between the 1970s and the 1980s where is Thatcher, and Thatcher encouraging everybody to be house owners. So what was the relationship between the private rental market, state rental market, and home ownership up until that time?
Okay. The private rental market had almost died. I mean, it had been regulated, so we had controlled rents, which got stronger in the 1970s. I think the market was only about 5% of households, which were, for the ones who were, a few old people in regulated rents, but most of the rest of the 5% were either university students, who were very good to put into slum housing. You know, so everybody's got to live in it. I did. It's cheap. £9 a week in Bedford and Newcastle. £9 rent a week and slugs. University students and private business people who are moving around very quickly, who might only be somewhere for a year and have a lot of money. That's what the private rented market got down to. And it was a good thing, because in general, just as individuals don't make, you know, you can't become a head teacher of a school and make up a school if you're an individual, or make your own hospital. Individuals are not very good at providing a service like housing. Right? We think we can become a landlord. It's a really complicated thing to do well. But Mrs. Thatcher and her party had a hatred of council housing. Part of it came from the Americans. The Americans, there's a lovely book on this, which, well, my memory is terrible, I do a view of it. But this is a book about American housing policy since the war, which has been to go around the world spreading the private market and giving aid money for America to make sure the private market get in, to stop socialised housing, because that was seen as dangerous and might lead to communism. And the biggest problem for America was the United Kingdom. Because in 1946, if you look at the 1946 birth cohort, majority of our children were growing up in council houses. Majority. Right? We had socialised housing, like we have socialised health. And so part of what happened, sorry for the long answer, part of the reason why the Conservatives and Margaret Thatcher had it so in for council housing was American advice and briefing saying, this is a really bad sign you're sending out, that you've got to get rid of this. And of course, she thought that it made people vote Labour. Mm. And so they brought in the right to buy, which is the biggest transfer of wealth ever to the poor. Well, it's got to be said, you know, that 40% discount was enormous. And you were almost a fool not to buy your council house if you'd been in it for long enough to get the discount. The problem then was that when people went to sell, they sold to a private landlord who then doesn't do it up, charges far more, and also, and this is crucial when it comes to efficiency, the private landlord will rent the council flat out to whoever will pay the most, which is often a single young professional living in a maisonette or a flat which used to have two parents and two children in it. And there's no faster way to, if you like, it's almost like burning houses, than go from housing allocated on the basis of need, where you're given a property you just fit into, to housing allocated on the basis of how much can you pay.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I remember we did some stuff about 10 years ago looking at what happens to older adults who are still in local authority housing when they want to downsize. Because they obviously don't have the choice that people who own their houses do. And I know there was a time, this must have been under Blair Brown, a real push to think about how can we allow them to go to retirement housing within the state sector that is sort of fair, and they can have the choice that people in private do. But I think the whole thing just sort of collapsed eventually.
It's really tricky. It's tricky in Oxford because, well, and I feel stupid for that, from the honest. One key issue when you get very old is you want to stay near your friends. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, obviously, you want to stay near your friends because they're what you've got, friends and family. You don't have work to socialise anymore. And so this solution, which I have to say the Green Party in the city want to say, of when you get old, move to Newcastle, because it's very environmental, it just doesn't work. So you, to be able to downsize, you need property that's very nearby. Mm-hmm. One of the saving graces, though, of all this is you desperately don't want stairs. So you want to move somewhere without stairs. That makes a lot of sense. So it's possible mm-hmm. we could do this, because staying in a house that's too big for you, that's drafty, that you can't clean and you can't afford to heat, with a staircase, which is a death trap as you get older, you know, we ought to be able to sort it out. Mm-hmm.
Julian, you've been waiting.
Thank you. It was truly fascinating listening to you. I was wondering, growing back on your comment, I think you said housing is connected to inequality. And I was wondering what we can do about it. Should we tackle housing laws in order to achieve equality, or should we tackle tax laws in order to achieve better housing situations? And also, people tend to vote for a government which, achieves more inequality. Should we also frame perhaps housing better as a human rights issue of bigger prominence?
Yeah. Oh, it's a very effective. But in terms of voting, our voting is now more affected by age than it's ever been. You know, age, in a way, is crudely more important than social class now for voting. And that has a lot to do, crudely, if you look at me. I'll show you my 2019 graph. And that's got quite a lot to do with the idea of you're going to take my house or my house wealth away, because so much of the wealth is owned by some of the elderly. The short answer, the problem is that, and you can look at how it's done in the past, you have to do everything at once. And you can't do it all that quickly unless you have disaster. Like a war. If you have a disaster like a war, then you can do things quicker than would normally be acceptable. But you can't choose one or the other. You have to bring in rent regulations, but you call them rent regulations, not controls, and you call it an even nicer name. You can also explain to people that the vast majority of them are losing out. So there's a con trick where you think that because you're sitting with a house that in theory is worth £500,000, you've got £500,000. The problem is that you haven't, because you need somewhere to live, and the people who are going to buy your house don't exist because they haven't got the money. But that's too hard. So governments are very, very good about making people thinking they'll be much better off in their old age than they really will. I think less than 7% of people pay inheritance tax, less than 12% in Kensington and Chelsea. But it's not just housing and inequality in income. It's things like education. You can do what you like with education. You will solve none of it if you let the income inequality stay and the housing problem stay. Because the housing problem creates these different ghettos in a city like this of who can live where, which then changes who goes to school where. So the problem is you've got to do it all at once. You then produce a manifesto, and this happened in 2019 and 2017, you produce a manifesto where in effect you list how you're going to do it all at once. You know, not even that dramatic, but you're going to tax the top 5% more, you're going to bring spending up to almost German levels. And people go, you're mad. And the people who go, you're mad, are the people who write the Guardian newspaper. Because they tend to be in the top 5%, and they look at these changes, and they say, you can't possibly deal with that. We don't like Conservatives, but, you know, we'll go with them. So it's, and it gets harder and harder as the inequality ramps up to really high levels. Because the vested interest is so high in not changing things. And you know, this is the interesting question about how does it break? What would it take to break it? Could it be 20 years? Could it be next year? But it never lasts forever. You don't stay the most unequal country in Europe for decades and decades and decades and get away with it. But things like Brexit.
It's very interesting, my frown was because I was going to ask you about education, but you've obviously sort of brought that in, so thank you. I'm just conscious that there may be people online. We normally have lots of people online who are asking questions. Please, we do have another question in the hall, but if anyone online would like to quickly put a yellow hand up, because we've only got room probably for two more questions. So whilst you're thinking about it, Yanan, I know you want to ask a question.
Thank you so much, Dan. And actually, I was very surprised when I see your last slide, which shows that in London now there is more and more empty houses. And actually, I had a question, which is corresponding to Julia's previous comment about is it possible some law or could they have the situation? So actually, in China now, because the housing issues, the incredible high housing prices, to make sure that people can afford a house, the government have released a series of restrictions on purchase house. For example, a couple only allowed it by one house or two houses in some cities. Do you think it could be helpful in the context of the UK? So I understand what you said, the whole problem can be solved in one go, but you know, some small changes may bring the differences in the market.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I've often thought the Chinese policy that a couple can't own more than two houses, you know, the fact that that isn't known in the UK, we often talk about Switzerland and how overseas buyers aren't allowed in parts of Switzerland. But it is a very obvious and very simple policy in China to do that. But it would shock people who own many houses, you know. You know, and that's where their wealth is and where their pension is. There's one other complicated thing going on in the world, which I think is fascinating, because China currently has what looks like the beginnings of a housing slump, with the prices going down, possibly. That's the kind of news. And this may be related to the pandemic, because China's pandemic was pretty good. The number of people who died in China was absolutely tiny, and in the whole of Southeast Asia is pretty low. Whereas in Europe and America, there were quite a lot of deaths. Now, the average age of death was about 81. In the UK, we lost 6% of all our 90-year-olds with COVID. On average, you don't get to 90 unless you're fairly well off. Most of our 90-year-olds are fairly well off. Most of them own houses. Might be in a home, but still own the house. One effect of the pandemic was that a lot of this property came on the market because of COVID deaths across Europe, in Britain and in America. The newspapers reported it as flight to the suburbs, flight to the countryside, without any of them asking who suddenly built houses in the countryside then. Okay? And what happened is that those sales were brought forward. They wouldn't have happened in 5 or 10 years anyway, but people died early because they got COVID. Average house prices appear to rise because the mix adjusted for this, so better off people's housing is sold. And it looks as if we've had the most incredible housing boom here, but it may be temporary. Opposite in China, hardly any deaths, no housing boom, much more realistic. And the two are completely separate. So we're getting these stories from China all the time about tower and flats which can't be sold and so on, even though people haven't died of COVID to the people. Whereas here we get the opposite, and just to go back to the start of your question, the empty homes are fascinating. In this city we know, because people claim council tax rebate, that most of the empty homes are in North Oxford, the most expensive part. In London, it's in the middle, in Kensington, Chelsea and Westminster. And my favourite quote, just to end on, is Norman Tebbit. And Norman Tebbit was Thatcher's, if you like, second in command in bringing in all these housing changes in the 80s. Norman Tebbit became a member of the House of Lords, and his chauffeur was driving him home one day from the House of Lords, and he was having to drive past block after block of flats with no lights on. And he just said, what's gone wrong? What's so terrible? How come I've got to spend so long at my age driving home when there are clearly all these empty homes in the middle of London? And the answer to what had gone wrong was that we left housing to the market, because they had the belief that the market was efficient in housing. And the market is very efficient at buying clothes and small items, but the market is absolutely terrible at buying any item that costs a lot of money where you can easily be fooled. And I just thought somebody should explain it to Norman Tebbit while he's still around, that the reason why he has housing problems in his own age is actually himself, and he helped to create it, and he did it without realising what it was he was doing.
Very interesting. And then Mohammed, can you be our last question, please.
Thank you very much for this interesting lecture. It's actually so many questions, so I'm just trying to pick the couple of them. I'm very interested to know your view. So do you think to have an equality, to eliminate inequality, people has to have the right to own a house or to live with dignity in a house? Because some other countries, not everyone owns a flat or a house, but the renting laws are good, so people don't have a problem with either renting or buying. That's the thing when you explain the GRI index for inequality. Sorry, did you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. When you explain the GRI index for inequality, which risen sharply after the 90s, this was the time of a little turbulence, economic issues, and interest rates was, I think, was around 10% or something like this. So there might be many reasons to contribute to this. I wonder if you can link what you were saying to that. Also, with regards to the comment by Kenneth, which was about London, it's not only London. Like, for example, in Surrey, it's easy to walk for a very nice big village to be told that this entire village owned by someone from Russia, and he just rents this luxury homes to people. So, and this, from reading and visiting, I think this is somehow on the increase in Surrey. And I recall many years ago, I had a problem when I found that in order to buy a bigger home, one of the people who compete against you is not living in this country at all. So I think, and if I recall the statistics, it's 70% of the properties that was sold used to be sold in London. It used to be sold outside, even before they are on the ground. So in a way, I don't think it's only like rich versus poor in UK. The point is UK's attraction for all over the world, and there are so many people with so much money are willing to buy, and this is disturbs the market. And the final question quickly is about, you mentioned about Finland. I have been to Finland, and I'm aware that homelessness is illegal. But Finland, as you are aware, is very different in terms of the Finnish population per square mile. I don't think anyone can live in minus 20 degrees anyway, so there's no place for homelessness in Finland. So I wonder what, when you said we should learn from Finland, what exactly did you mean?
Okay, let's quickly do those in reverse order.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dave. So, on learning about homelessness in Finland, 20 years ago Finland did have tens of thousands of homeless people in Helsinki, despite the cold. I need to turn your microphone off, sorry. They survived because the toilets, the public toilets were heated. And you can see this now, if you look at Canada, which is, yeah, parts of Canada are similarly cold, but they have homeless rates. Overseas buyers. It has an effect at the very top end of the market. And partly that, the last question about China, one of the reasons for price rises in London was couples only being allowed to own two houses in China, meant that a very wealthy couple from China might just own two houses in China, but they can own four in London as well. And that had an effect on our market. It's only a small part of the market, but the problem is it then changes people's mentality in the West. So you begin to think of a house costing £1 million as being reasonable without thinking how much the bricks cost, how much does it actually cost to build it. Because the other house is worth 32, 35 million in the city. On interest rates, yes, it was a different time. I was standing outside the Treasury when they went up to 50%. Spent 5 hours just outside that day. But it's unlikely to come back. The one thing I would say is, we're not getting a rise today, we're going to get a tiny rise in the next few months in interest rates. But the UK now has a very small currency called sterling. which is less protected by the rest of Europe. So if we ever have a run on the pound again, the only way you defend the pound is by rising interest rates, and that's going to be interesting. And lastly, about should everybody be able to get a house or not, it doesn't really matter, other than I do think people who like doing their own decorations should be able to own their house so they can do it. And there's a huge variation around the world. So in Singapore, which is the most unequal OECD country, 80% of the housing is provided by the government very well, which partly makes the inequality possible elsewhere. Back to Finland, and okay, it's a big country, and although it can be minus 20 in the north in winter, it's plus 20 in summer, and a large number of families, if not most, own a rickety second home by a lake, somewhere lovely to go to, which you can do. So you can have Finland, the most equal country in Europe, and you can have your holiday home if you get your utopia sorted out properly. So there are different variations of the possible. But the key thing is you just don't want people rattling around with more property than they need, property they're never living, just for investments, and other people where the children have to share bedrooms in their teenage years when they're of the opposite sex, and that's on the rise in Britain at the moment. Thank you.
Okay, Danny, I think we're going to have to sadly leave it there, but can we thank you again, as I say, for most such a stimulating talk, and actually some fascinating details in your questions. So can we thank Danny again?